Hi everyone, and welcome to today's webinar, Parenting in Contexts of Family Violence and Interparental Conflict, Implications for Practice. My name is Amanda Colero, and I'm the Manager of Knowledge Translation here at the Australian Institute of Family Studies. Today's webinar presentation will explore the implications of recent research on women and children's experiences of family violence and interparental conflict. Before I introduce our speakers, I would like to acknowledge the traditional custodians of the lands on which we are meeting. In Melbourne, the traditional custodians are the Wurundjeri people of the Kulin Nation. I pay my respects to their elders, past and present, and to the elders from other communities who may be participating today. It's now my pleasure to introduce today's presenters, Kathy Humphreys and Catherine Lyons. Kathy Humphreys is Professor of Social Work at the University of Melbourne. Kathy is also co-chair of the Melbourne Research Alliance to End Violence Against Women and Their Children, MAVE, and one of the lead investigators on the Safer Families Centre for Research Excellence, led by Professor Kelsey Hegarty. Her research in the domestic violence area includes projects on substance abuse, mental health, child abuse, strengthening the mother-child relationship, and multi-agency working and reform. She currently works on a range of projects, including Fathering Challenges, which examines responsible, reparative, and responsive fathering in the context of domestic violence, the Patricia Project, which explores the interface between child protection and domestic violence services, the Domestic and Family Violence and Parenting Project, led by Dr. Ray Kaspiev, which explores the impact of domestic and family violence on mothering and fathering, the Caring Dads Evaluation Project, and Invisible Practices, which focuses on interventions with fathers who use violence. Catherine Lyons is the manager of the Geelong Family Relationship Centre and Parenting Orders Program, working in the area of separated families. Catherine has practiced as a social worker for the last 16 years in the area of children, adolescents, parenting and family, including roles at a migrant resource centre and the Royal Children's Hospital. Catherine is an active participant of the Victorian Family Relationship Centre's Managers Group and the Victorian Parenting Orders Program Managers Group, both of which are professional networks that aim to ensure collaborative practice, processes and staff development across the state of Victoria. She is also a member of the Barwon Area Integrated Family Violence Committee and the Barwon South West Family Law Pathways Committee. Please join me in giving our presenters a very warm virtual welcome.
So thank you very much for that introduction, Amanda. As Amanda said, I'm Kathy Humphreys, speaking on parenting in the context of family violence and family conflict, and particularly focusing on the implications from research and practice. Within that area, I am also doing some focusing on fathers who use domestic and family violence. Now, I just need to begin by recognising that this is a very sensitive subject, and not only because most people who are listening to this webinar would have had some experience of domestic and family violence, either through loved ones growing up with family violence, friends that you know, or through the clients that you work with. So we're not talking about something that isn't relevant to the lives of people that are listening to this webinar. But it's also an issue in relation to a quite big separation in the domestic violence intervention system. Particularly when we're looking at separated families, this relates to family law, which becomes, and the arena around family law. Now, for anyone working in the family violence area with women and children, women's legal services, specialist family violence services, refuges, there's actually an enormous sense of despair about the decision-making and the culture in the family law area. And only yesterday I was talking about a program which is doing work with mother-child strengthening, lovely group work in this space, but talking to the facilitators, they're saying, well, of course, what we're doing is actually having to work with most of these women about how they're managing their children following child contact and managing the issues in relation to how distressed these children are when they're coming back from having had contact with fathers who have used domestic and family violence. However, when you move to the family relationship sector, you get an entirely different story. And they tell about the progress that's being made in relation to domestic and family violence and the ways in which they are working in this space. And so that's why I'm terribly grateful that Catherine Lyons is here to talk about this issue as well, so that we get some sort of balance in the discussion that we're having in this webinar. Slide. So when you've got too much to say and not enough time to say it in, I was told it's a very good idea to start with your last slide. So that's what I've done. I've started with my last slide, putting it first, because the key messages aren't messages that you want to get lost in the big rush at the end. So I'm going to give you those key messages and then work the presentation back from there. So my key messages: the needs and well-being of children whose lives are impacted by domestic and family violence need to be taken seriously. We need to recognise that men who use violence are also fathers who use violence, and that domestic and family violence is a parenting choice. That fathers who use violence do not magically become good fathers on separation. That reparation for the impact of their violence is an important part of healing relationships with their children. And that programs and interventions for fathers who use violence are currently very undeveloped in our service system. We have a service system that's been very focused on the adult and not necessarily on thinking about the mothers and fathers involved, particularly where there's domestic and family violence. Slide. So I'll be drawing on different research projects, particularly the PACT project, Parenting Abuse and Control Tactics, in which Dr. Ray Kaspiev, was the lead. She was clearly someone who many of you have known, worked with AFES for many years and is now on secondment to the Australian Law Reform Commission. So I'm speaking on behalf of this research team. And there were three big strands of research in the PACT project. There was the analysis of the LSAC data on parental conflict. So the LSAC data is a longitudinal study of a large group of Australian children, not ones that are specifically related to domestic violence, just a prevalent study, a population prevalence study, where different waves continue so that we're following through children across their lifespan. So there was an analysis in relation to parental conflict in that database. Then there was also the analysis of the separated families data, where ACE has the big databases. And then within that, we interviewed 50 women who had lived with domestic and family violence and talked to them about their experiences of both mothering and their experiences about the fathering that they experienced from their partner or ex-partner. That will be the area where I'll be concentrating on, because that was the area of the research that I was involved in. I will also draw on a couple of other projects, the Fathering Challenges Project, because those interviews with women were part of the Fathering Challenges Project as well. And we also will be looking at some issues that were raised in terms of talking about children's experiences of fathering, because they had some very clear views about fathering that I thought are relevant to this discussion and webinar. Slide. So the PACT project team was led by Dr. Ray Kaspiev with Dr. Leisha Q, Dr. Bryony Horsfield, and then there was a team from University of Melbourne and a team from the Judith Lumley Centre. So I just wanted to acknowledge those colleagues of mine who are very much a part of this project, and that some of the slides that are being used in this webinar are from Ray Kaspiev. Slide. Just want to start, because some of you will be going, well, why concentrate on fathers who use domestic and family violence? And I just wanted to make the case about a gendered analysis, so that we actually recognise that domestic and family violence is a gendered issue, that in fact 80, when you look at the child death, the sorry, the domestic homicide data, 80% of men have created homicides against women in where there's been domestic homicide. Similarly, the Children's Commission, when they looked at children and children's deaths, more than 50% of 127 deaths were children who were experiencing domestic and family violence. The majority was violence by men towards the child's mother. So I think there's those issues that we need to hang on to. If we're talking about domestic and family violence, we need to recognise that it is a gendered issue. I should just show you the population data from the Personal Safety Survey, which again, 5% of men experiencing physical violence or threat and 17% of women, so three times as many women. But significantly, 4.3 times as many women as men reporting fear or anxiety after the most recent incident, and 41% of women experiencing post-separation violence. So we need to recognise that the violence doesn't necessarily stop with separation. Just to mention, the British Crime Survey always point to this in terms of the gendered analysis because it does show, because they measured violence in a different way, they mentioned it on a basis of incidents, does show that many men will say, quite legitimately, that they have been hit or experienced some sort of physical violence. But then when you analyse further, four or more incidents, it's 89% were women. Of all the incidents, 81% involved violence by men against women. Overwhelmingly, women the most severely injured and the most fearful. So it's not to say that there isn't quite a lot of physical conflict in relationships, but when you're looking to chronic patterns, you're looking at a gendered issue. One of the problems with the LSAC data is it didn't have a measure of domestic and family violence. It only had a measure of parental conflict. And so we're looking at, and that will include issues which are in fact domestic violence as well as issues around parental conflict. For the most part, where you see significant and chronic interparental conflict, you probably, that is an issue of domestic and family violence. There are a number of research questions which were part of the PACT project and which you can see up on the screen. Slide. I just thought I'd start with the prevalence data because I want to drill down a little while to the qualitative data and people will go, well, you know, that's too, that, you know, what about all the others? So I just wanted to put this in the context of interparental violence and conflict. So when you're looking at the first wave of 4 to 5 year olds, there were 76% where there was no reported interparental conflict. There was 18% where there was past or emerging interparental conflict, and there was 6% where it was persistent interparental conflict. So you've got a group of children who, when they were very young, were living with significant, 6% of a population study were living with persistent chronic interparental conflict. When you look at the 8 to 9 year olds, it had moved to about 8 to 9% who were living with persistent interparental conflict. So slide. In terms of that interparental conflict and the family structure, so when you looked at the 12 to 13 year olds and what was the family structures they were living in, well, actually, of the separated families, there were 40% of those with interparental conflict where there was a reporting of current and ongoing interparental conflict, and 10% within the study where they weren't separated. So I guess what that means is that we have to be really clear that there's a lot of post-separation violence and that we actually haven't got a service system that's well established to deal with post-separation violence and recognise post-separation violence. So moving across to domestic family violence and the separated family studies, what they saw, and when they looked at a large cohort of the separated families that are part of the AFE database, that in terms of physical hurt and emotional abuse that was associated with negative interparental relationships with a lot of fear and safety concerns, high levels of parental stress, and increased financial hardship. I'm just going to move across the fact that children are harmed through the processes of domestic and family violence, and that's why I want to continue to raise that as an issue. But we also need to recognise, and I'm going to move on to Katie Lamb's study, which says actually children also have a lot of agency and they've got some very clear views. She interviewed in a qualitative study 16 young people about their experiences of what they wanted from, what they expected and wanted from a good father. And then there were eight of those young people who then constructed digital stories that could be used in men's behaviour change programs or fathering programs that were specific for fathers who use violence. I've made the website link because we actually haven't got the technology to be able to play the digital story. But I do urge you to go back and see a couple of the digital stories because they're very powerful messages from children. And one of the clearest messages from children was they were very keen to have reparation. That, in fact, when they were living with domestic and family violence, they wanted their fathers to address the past, to acknowledge the wrongdoing, to acknowledge the harm they'd caused, to apologise, to accept the consequences. All of the children in different ways said this, and certainly they didn't use the term reparation, but we as researchers pulled it together going, these children are looking for reparation. They want to address the past. They want a commitment to change. They want more than an apology. They want not just to say sorry and then do it all again. They want an apology that's followed by change. And they wanted a rebuilding of trust and investing in time and effort. And they really wanted, just about all of them mentioned, they wanted them to stop bagging out their mothers. And that was considered by them to be part of the need to rebuild trust. Slide. There were other projects as well that we've done that highlight the issues for children when you interview children about their relationships with their fathers. You know, these are relationships where the father is a great source of confusion for many of the children. They fear anger and sadness towards their father, but many of them miss their fathers following separation. Others of them resent being forced into unwanted contact. So there's a range of issues that are very confusing in this space for children, but nevertheless ones that highlight how difficult the issues are when we don't have programs that demand and support the healing processes that are needed for children to manage the issues in relation to post-separation violence or even violence that's happening. So I want to now move to the qualitative data based on the 50 interviews with women. And what you see is that fathering under what circumstances is very complicated and changing. So that with these 50 women, there were four who were still living with their partners and one of whom was separated under the same roof. And of the separated mothers, 70%, that's 35, had at least one child who was mainly living with them. And there were 12 mothers who had no overnight stays for their children. But of this group of 35 mothers, most of whom had lived with actually very serious domestic and family violence was what they were reporting. And so their children had lived with very serious domestic and family violence. But of those 35 women, six reported at least one child living mainly with the father. Six mothers reported all their children living with the father. Six mothers reported shared care contact, 50-50 contact, and nine mothers reported weekly contact. So in short, there were 27 mothers who had children who had full-time care or extensive contact with their fathers following separation. So I think that when we've got a service system, and particularly the child protection system, which often sees separation as a point of safety, for many of these children, they may be no better off with separation. In fact, the protections that are built in there from their mothers being there as the non-offending parent may be taken away from them. And so we actually often say to women, why don't you leave? But then we don't allow children to leave violent relationships. And we don't do the repairing with their fathers that's required to make those relationships non-violent. Slide. Because if you look at some of the issues that were reported by women in these 50 women who were interviewed, prior to separation, they were reporting very high levels of child abuse. Now, you could say that if you're living with domestic and family violence, then in fact that's all physical and emotional abuse. But they were also reporting other forms of child abuse, a lot of physical abuse, some sexual abuse, some neglect, that was very striking. One of the things I should say is that this physical, you know, that the child abuse seemed to have very little impact on the initial childcare arrangements that were made, not all of which were court-ordered by any means. A lot of them were, at separation, there was a lot of bargaining done, sometimes with the help of the formal system and the family relationship services, other times it was just agreed. But in several cases, like in five of the cases where there was extensive contact with fathers, that was then revoked and moved to supervised or no contact once very serious abuse in relation to child contact was shown and demonstrated. So what we saw with those five cases is that children were extensively abused on contact in ways that were so concerning that the abuse was revoked. But in fact, when you think about it, that should not be happening. That is systems abuse, a lot of that. And we need to be thoughtful about what we're putting children through. There's a range of issues that mothers reported in terms of their own parenting, about trying to function when there's domestic and family violence. There's a regime of control. The most common metaphor used was we're walking on eggshells. I actually thought that when I was reading through the transcripts and analysing the transcripts, I think, oh, I've done this one. But no, they kept on using this metaphor of working more than, you know, a lot of women use this metaphor of walking on eggshells. They had a lot of commentary. Some of it was, you know, we prompted and asked women to talk about the positive attributes of their partners or ex-partners, these all of whom had been domestically violent. So a lot of women could talk about some positive attributes, but if you look at that quote there, you will see that it's full of yes, they had some good aspects, but they were very undermined by some extremely concerning behaviour from the father. And so they talked a lot about the poor knowledge and skills that fathers had, who were in this cohort of domestically violent fathers. They also talked, about children replicating their father's behaviour. So this is really concerning behaviour, I guess, is the seeds of intergenerational abuse, isn't it? That 20 mothers, actually unprompted because it wasn't one of our questions in the interview schedule, talked about children replicating their father's behaviours. They're lovely but also very difficult. They've come back from his house very angry. My child last night, he had a two-hour tantrum where he was throwing things and hitting his sister and smashing windows and smashing doors. These women were talking. Some women left at the point and when they saw their children replicating the behaviour. Others were finding it being replicated when children came home from contact. But you can see when you look at the LSAC data, where you've got no interparental conflict reported, the blue bar would show that children can sometimes return from contact withdrawn and unhappy and critical of their mothers and having difficulty settling. But when you look at those where you've got chronic interpersonal violence, interpersonal conflict, so that's the orange bar, you can see it's two or three times as much. So it's not to say that children often aren't upset when they return from their fathers, from contact, but actually when it's much, much greater where you've had domestic and family violence reported. There were some men who were seeking help, and we need to recognise that, but a lot of it women felt was quite self-interested and they didn't see much effect. Those who saw effects from men attending parenting programs or men's behaviour change programs were those where they saw case management support occurring alongside. So just to finish off, the LSAC data, the AFES data and the interview data say interpersonal interparental conflict and domestic violence does not stop for many families after separation, that exposure to interparental conflict or domestic and family violence is associated with poorer outcomes for children and especially poorer where interparental conflict or domestic and family violence is sustained. So just returning to those key messages, and I just go back to the final message there, that programs and interventions for fathers who use violence are currently very undeveloped, and we do need to recognise the fact that actually mainstream parenting programs do not do the business that's required, particularly in relation to reparation, for these fathers who are using violence. There's actually more that's required. Many of the parenting programs are about how you maintain discipline and control. Actually, most of these fathers don't have a lot of problem with discipline and control, but not necessarily in healthy ways. So that we do need to develop the programs that are for fathers who have a history of using violence. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Kathy, and thank you also to AFES for having me here today. I think this is a really welcome opportunity to talk about the practice implications for parenting in the context of family violence and interparental conflict. So as has been mentioned, I've been at the Geelong Family Relationship Centre now for almost 10 years, so hopefully there's quite a bit of practice experience that I've had over those years that I can share with you today. Slide. So in future, I'll certainly use Kathy's tip on putting your key messages first in a presentation, but I haven't done that today. What I have done is given an overview of the presentation, so hopefully you'll find that there are all the pieces there that you would like to hear about. So I'll talk a little bit about the information about the context of practice, about assessment for family violence and interparental conflict. I also will touch on the impact of conflict on children and young people, because we see that so much in our service. I'll talk about family violence, interparental conflict and parenting, and some of the interventions that we use, but also some of the dilemmas. And I think Kathy has certainly touched on many of those already. And what we see in practice is that this is very complex work. There are many dilemmas within it. We haven't got it exactly right, but hopefully we are striving, you know, to make it better for separated families. And I will end on some future directions. Slide. So I'll talk just briefly about the umbrella underneath which we sit as a family law service and a family relationship centre, and that is, of course, the Family Law Act. So that was introduced in 1975. It's had many amendments since then, but many would be aware that some more significant amendments occurred in 2006, such as the rebuttable presumption of equal and shared parental responsibility, some quite significant changes to language regarding living arrangements for children, and certainly far more emphasis on non-legal resolution of parenting matters. And that, of course, includes family dispute resolution or mediation. So in 2006 and 2007, 65 family relationship centres were rolled out across Australia, as well as a host of other family law services that offered support and education to separated parents. So the aims of family relationship centres are to support families through separation, and that's certainly the core work that we do through mediation, through some counselling and also the parenting orders program. It's around strengthening family relationships in whatever their form and also focusing parents on the needs of their children. Slide. So the section of the Act that is most relevant, I think, for our work is Section 60CA, and that is, of course, around the best interests of children. So it must be our paramount consideration. It talks about the benefit of children having a meaningful relationship with both of their parents, but it also importantly talks about the need for children to be protected from physical or psychological harm and not be subjected to or exposed to abuse, neglect, or family violence. That sounds simple, but of course it is very complex and certainly complex in practice. And that section also talks about Aboriginal or Torres Strait Islander children having the right to maintain connection to their culture, to have support and opportunity and, of course, encouragement to explore their culture, but that must be consistent with their developmental age and stage. Slide. So just lastly, in terms of the Act, I think that one of the most significant parts of the Act for us now, of course, is the Family Law Legislation Amendment, or Family Violence and Other Measures Act 2011. So I won't go through the full definition. If you're interested, that's in section 4AB. But it has direct implications for matters relating to the safety of children and, of course, best interests. And it also talks about mandatory and discretionary reporting obligations for practitioners in this field. So it certainly refers to children's exposure to family violence. But as I think Cathy has absolutely highlighted, and what we see in our service, is that incidences of family violence, including those where children are present, do not end at the point of separation. And in fact, this is a time where it may escalate. And in fact, most parents and families that come into contact with a family relationship centre are there because of some form of interparental conflict or potentially family violence. Slide. So assessment for family violence and interparental conflict is an incredibly important part of work and practice in an FRC. And we know that it may coexist, family violence and interparental conflict, but it's also important to assess where possible for family violence and distinguish it from interparental conflict. I would like to certainly acknowledge, and I have read those studies, and I know that there are reports from particularly women who state that they were not asked about family violence and safety concerns during formal family law processes, and that includes mediation. But I would like to think that in 10 years we have made some improvements in this area. There are a lot more to come, but I think some of the tools that we are using the Common Risk Assessment Framework in Victoria, which is currently being reviewed and updated, the Attorney General Department Screening and Assessment Guide, the DOORS Guide, for example, and also AVERT. And it's very exciting to see that there's currently some review of the intake and assessment tools that we use in family law services through ANROS and the Attorney General's Department. I would certainly like to note, though, that assessment for family violence must be ongoing throughout a mediation process. There cannot be a start and finish point. We must be constantly on alert for any issues of family violence and safety. I won't go through all the types of family violence that's there on the slide for you to refer to, but I would certainly reiterate again that we must assess not only a history of family violence, but family violence post-separation. We must be considering safety of children, but also the impact the violence has had on them and also on their parents and their parenting capacity. We also need to really consider recommendations from child protection, because a number of families do come to us via that pathway. And I would also note that while family relationship centres must conduct mediation in an impartial manner, certainly our own data, and I note that there is a lot of research around this, but our own client data and assessment information shows far higher numbers of women reporting family violence. That's not to say that there are men and fathers who report that also to us, but overwhelmingly our figures would show that it is more women that are reporting this. Slide. So some of the practice considerations that we really need to be focused on in FRC services, as I've said, is of course the safety of parents and children. That must be our primary concern. And sometimes we need to look at what safety measures are required, and perhaps our service isn't the right service. Perhaps a referral is needed. I think, though, that mediation services are in a very unique position in that we do meet with both parents a lot of the time. We would meet with the parent who has perpetrated family violence, and we would meet with the other parent who has been affected by family violence. So supporting disclosure around family violence is, of course, incredibly important. And there has been, I think, a lot of research in how we do this. And there is a balance, of course, between direct questioning but also avoiding re-traumatisation of our clients. So I think our practice experience tells us that with thorough but respectful questioning, and of course the engagement skills of the practitioner, parents are able to disclose family violence to us. Not all of the time, I note that, but sometimes these parents are disclosing it for the very first time. We need to pay particular attention to the questioning of parents who have been violent, so we must address behaviour and not collude with it. But I would also see, and I certainly have in my role as a manager, seen this in practice, where the mediation process may be being used by the abuser as a means of engaging the other parent. And that's something we must not be a part of. We would also see in practice that there may be parents, and it often is the mother, who might appear positional in the mediation process, but in fact what she's trying to do is act protectively towards her children. And we certainly see in practice there are cases where there has been very significant coercive controlling behaviour, and it might be in that case that mediation is not a suitable process. So, of course, all along the way in assessment, we must be thinking also about referral pathways. So what specialist and therapeutic services may be needed for this family? Slide. So just moving on a little bit more now to the impact of conflict, particularly on children and young people. There is a fantastic DVD that we use in our child-focused information sessions called Remember Me. I have put the link to that clip in the slides. I'd love to give some case scenarios today, but time doesn't permit that. So I would really encourage you to have a look at that DVD. It's very powerful. It talks about the impact of conflict on children, but it also really highlights the parents' experience of that conflict and the impact it has on their parenting capacity. Slide. So I would also just like to talk briefly about shared care and interparental conflict and family violence. It is a contentious issue, and I'm very well aware of some of the assumptions that are made about shared care. So one of them certainly, and it's often made by parents, is that equal and shared parental responsibility under the Family Law Act must equate to equal time. I think there's also a concern that shared and equal time or care would be favoured over the safety of children and parents with the changes to the Family Law Act. And also there's an assumption, I think sometimes, that family relationship centres advocate for shared and equal time in the majority of cases. But I think over 10 years, what I have seen, and I know there's still a long way to go, is actually an increased awareness, even in the court system. When we have magistrates come down to Geelong to the circuit courts, they're talking to us more and more about the fact that equal time can actually be detrimental to children where there's significant conflict between their parents. And that's because we have to consider that these children are trying to navigate two incredibly separate worlds which have no connection to one another. And we also must consider, of course, the developmental stage of children and how the conflict has impacted upon them. Slide. So in terms of the impact of family violence on parenting capacity and what we see in practice, I certainly again would reiterate the studies that certainly have shown that family violence does not necessarily end at the point of separation. We certainly see in practice the impact it has on parents' mental health, the trauma and the psychological abuse that they may have experienced. But we also see many parents who over many, many years have had their parenting strengths and capabilities undermined. We do see mothers' capacity to act protectively at times is compromised by fear, power and control. And sometimes we'll see that they've been told, even by systems such as child protection, to just leave the relationship. And we expect that that will solve everything, but we know that it doesn't. It's interesting to hear Kathy refer to some of the women talking about walking on eggshells, because we certainly hear that metaphor often in our practice. That mothers report feeling very tense and agitated with their children, even within the relationship, as they were trying to continually modify their behaviour in order not to escalate the violence in the home. We also meet sometimes with fathers who have used violence, and they may be exhibiting overly controlling and punitive parenting behaviours. I would also note that parents who have not had significant involvement in parenting or caregiving with their children, it may not actually be appropriate for them to have substantial time, at least initially. We certainly see an incredible impact in terms of financial hardship, and that's often raised in a mediation context. And we're also seeing actually more recently more cases where there has been adolescent violence, where adolescents, particularly boys, may, as Kathy said, replicate the violence that they have seen in their home. And we certainly see often ruptures to the parent-child relationship. So I think it's really important in the context of parenting to be asking, how do you think this has impacted your children? How do you think this has impacted upon your parenting? Slide. So what we certainly know, when parenting capacity is lessened by interparental conflict particularly, children will be exposed to ongoing parental conflict, and that actually includes non-communication. Children become messengers between their parents. We see that they have to share information between their parents because they're not capable of doing that themselves. We see an incredible emotional burden that's ongoing for children and their parents. And we also can see that there is developmental progress being compromised, particularly in that 0-4 age group. We often do mediations with parents who are recently separated with very, very young children and very, very young infants. So we have to be very mindful of children's developmental age and stage. We also see that parents are at times unable to support their children's relationship with the other parent. And in casework more recently, again, we're seeing situations where siblings are split between their parents. So one sibling is with one parent, the other with the other parent, and siblings are actually not having a lot of contact with each other. And of course, it goes without saying that parents in these situations are unable to effectively co-parent. Slide. So when parenting capacity is enhanced, though, hopefully what we're able to see is that parents are able to help their children emotionally after separation, that they can become more present emotionally and tune into their needs, that children receive reassurance that they're loved by both of their parents and can be loyal to both. And I'm not talking about, though, in that situation where there has been violence. Hopefully older children are able to have a voice, but their parents still take responsibility for making decisions. And hopefully children will experience smoother transitions, which help them feel supported and safe, including when we introduce new adult relationships into their lives. So what can we do? Hopefully we can help shift the focus from the other parent to their own parenting and support them with their own strengths. What are they proud of? How can they support their children? How do they ensure they're safe and emotionally tune into their needs? We can build strong and safe attachments for infants and toddlers, and it's really important that we intervene at an early point there. That perhaps ourselves or indeed other services can provide the space for the repair of parent-child relationships and restore parental capacity with therapeutic interventions, of which, of course, we need far more of. Slide. So some of the interventions that I'll now talk about that we may use or we may refer on to as we look for opportunities to untangle that presenting conflict. I think practitioners must be empathic, but challenging as well. Often this is very entrenched conflict and we need to challenge that behaviour. Some of the tools that practitioners may use could be, for example, the experiences of caregiving interview, the adult attachment scale. Sometimes with children, we use the child's perception of parental conflict scale. We use the child-focused information and education part of our process as early on as possible. And many parents will come up to us after our information sessions, noting that if only we had attended this earlier. I think we hopefully can engage men in their fathering role. And I think FRCs have a unique position here because we often do see both parents, and often they are motivated for some change. There's some really creative and flexible models of service delivery that are happening right now in FRCs. For example, the Family Safety Navigation Model at Melbourne and Sunshine FRC. And there's a link at the end of the presentation if you're interested in hearing more about that. The Family Safety Service Model at Northern Beaches Sydney FRC is another one. But I think more and more we'll be using legally assisted mediation in FRCs, where perhaps because of the complexity of family violence, parents may need a support person in the form of a solicitor. But I think what we need to do certainly more of, and we're very fortunate in the Geelong and Barwon region, that even as part of the FRC consortium, we're partners with MacKillop Family Services, with Catholic Care, with Barwon Child, Youth and Family, and the City of Greater Geelong, and we need to work in partnership with them. Also with the Children's Contact Service, with specialist family violence services for women, children and men, again, in the Barwon area. So I think these networks are important, perhaps they are underutilised and we need to, I think, work with them more into the future. Slide. I'm just going to talk, before I finish also, about a particular program that is offered, fortunately, at the Geelong FRC. It's also offered across Victoria and Australia, and that's the Parenting Orders Program. So the Parenting Orders Program works with families who are in incredibly high conflict. They are often in and out of court and still unable to work through arrangements. So we work with individual counselling, we offer groups and seminars to hopefully strengthen parental capacity, to look at the co-parenting relationship and the communication between parents, and to assist parents in understanding how that conflict is not only impacting themselves and their parenting, but their children too. And it's also a lot about strategies, about how we can reduce that conflict and what strategies can be put in place. The other part of that program, and a lot of court referrals come to us via this work, is what we call repair work. So supporting parents, again, where there's been very entrenched conflict, to re-establish relationships with their children. It's restorative practice and it must be at the child's pace, and we meet with children throughout that program. Another intervention that we can use, of course, is child-informed family dispute resolution, developed by Jennifer McIntosh and Family Transitions and La Trobe University, which really supports disputing parents to actively consider the voice of their children. Slide. Some of the dilemmas, though, I think that we face in this incredibly complex work are certainly where we're working with parents who are attempting to make parenting arrangements or decisions when their parenting capacity and thought processes have been compromised by the experience of family violence. We also see sometimes that we're getting referrals from child protection and families are coming to us via that pathway, but perhaps an assessment has not been conducted with the perpetrator of family violence, and therefore we are unaware of any recommendations that might be made regarding the safety of children. And I think that, unfortunately, that is still a gap and something we need to work better at. I think parents who minimise or justify their abusive behaviours and therefore will not consider the requirement of time with the children being supervised. It is sometimes difficult to engage with and include both parents in interventions. You might have one parent that's very motivated and the other parent not so. But I think overwhelmingly an incredible dilemma for us is that there are parents who, without our service, will continue to engage in contact arrangements that may impact on their children's psychological and emotional safety. They can't access legal resources for whatever reason, and we know that they will just continue to send their children to the person that has been violent because that, in their eyes, is the safer thing to do. So there are lots of professional dilemmas that we have around decision making. Slide. So just to finish with, in terms of the future landscape, there's certainly, I think, a very important review happening right now, the Australian Law Reform Commission's review into the Family Law Act, led by Helen Rhodes. We need to certainly work with the recommendations from the Royal Commission into Family Violence in Victoria. And I think FRCs hopefully will work in partnership with the support and safety hubs, one of which is being piloted in the Barwon area. There also has been, of course, a parliamentary inquiry into a better family law system to protect those affected by family violence. But in practice, we must continue to ensure the safety of children and those affected by family violence. We must get better at that. We need to place more emphasis on the particular impact that family violence and interparental conflict has on parenting capacity. We need to continue to build stronger relationships with child protection and other specialist family violence services, and refer to those services wherever possible. But I think we certainly need to see an increase in resources for fathers who have used violence. And I'm very excited to see that Bethany Community Support in Geelong are hopefully going to be putting a lot more resource into this in the coming year through their Men's Centre. Slide. So just to finish, I think it's important to continually bring the focus back to children and parenting. It's certainly, in terms of conflict and family violence, one of the most significant issues that's reported by parents that access an FRC service. So we must place great emphasis on supporting these parents to not only understand the impact on themselves but their children, and also provide them the means to engage in therapeutic and educative processes to support sustained change. Thank you.